Let's see what the stew has for us today. Welcome to the Gnomecast, the Gnome Stew's tabletop gaming advice podcast. Here we talk with other gnomes about gnome things to avoid becoming part of the stew. So I guess we'd better be good. Today we have JT, Phil, and myself, Chris. Before we get to the topic at hand, let us ask our first question in our first segment, Get to Know a Gnome. JT, first off, welcome to the first Gnomecast that you've been on.
Cool, thank you, thank you.
And second, would you please let folks at home know something about you that they might not know?
Sure. So I guess I got two tidbits here. In the day job, I keep computers secure, you know, keep the bad guys out and the good guys in. And I'm also a short story and writer and a novelist. And my first novel's coming out pretty imminently, probably in the next 2 or 3 months.
What is the name of this novel?
It is Griffin's Feather.
Would you please give us the summary of it?
Sure, I can give you the hook line there. It's basically about a immortal Roman centurion who works as a bounty hunter for the gods of the ancient world in modern-day San Antonio.
Sounds awesome.
Well, I'm going to pick it up and read it because it's a modern fantasy, and I love everything modern fantasy, so there you go.
Yeah, it's definitely an urban fantasy, yeah.
Very cool. That's very cool. I can't wait to get my hands on it and read it and talk about it.
Cool.
Phil, what about you?
So I've done this once or twice, so I'm like constantly now pressed to think of different things I can mention. So I think I'll mention this time that I used to be a really big comic book nerd back in the 80s. And I know you know this, Chris, but I don't think listeners do. I was a big comic book nerd in the 80s, and I collected a lot of different comic books. And then I let it drop off for a while, but I've recently gotten back into it with the Marvel Unlimited subscription service. So I've been reading like a ton of comic books as of late, and kind of old ones and new ones, and kind of getting caught up on Marvel Universe stuff. I'm a big Marvel guy. So it's actually been really fun. It's been fun to go back, and I've went back and read like a bunch of the my favorite series ever, the Claremont X-Men run. But I've also now been reading a lot of new stuff that I'm really digging. So I'm having kind of a comic book renaissance, so to speak.
Very cool. Do either of you have a question for me, since I have done this 11 times or 10 times?
Oh, I guess probably a pretty generic question that I got for you. And I'm sure you've probably said this a few times on Misdirected Mark or other podcasts, but I've never heard the story. So kind of what got you into podcasting? Because you've done it, you know, a lot.
7 or 8 years ago, I was a garbage man. And what I listened to a lot of the times I was throwing garbage is sports talk radio, because we have a pretty decent sports talk radio station in Buffalo, New York. And then I found out there are these things called podcasts, and I got an iPod Nano for Christmas. And then I found out there are role-playing game podcasts, so I downloaded things like Fear the Boot and The Bear Swarm. Oh, yeah. And then Happy Jacks. And I'm like, huh, this is pretty cool. And then I tried to start like 3 or 4 times and realized that just sometimes you got to spend the money so you can get the sound quality. And then I spent a whole bunch of money a couple of years after that on a mixer and some decent microphones and whatnot and got started. And ever since then, it's been that. So my inspirations were, you know, those classic ones. I guess you can call them classic podcasts like Fear the Boot and The Bear Swarm, which doesn't exist anymore, which makes me sad, and Happy Jacks.
Cool.
And that's how I got started. Spent way too much money. You don't need to spend that much money now. Just letting you know. It's really cheap to get into podcasting.
Oh, yeah.
It's like $100 for a decent microphone and your laptop.
Right. That's about what I spent on my mic, and it's a good one, so.
Yeah, it only gets complicated if you want to put more mics on. Like,
right.
Then yeah. You get into mixer land, but short of that, yeah.
Short of that. All right, let's get to the article at hand. So we're going to talk about Player Intent, which is written by JT Evans, which I chose that because I knew JT was going to be on the show.
Cool.
I'm going to give you the real quick summary of the article, folks at home. First, there's an introduction, and that talks about how understanding what players want is very important. Then JT talks about the macro decisions, which are the large-scale results of the actions the PCs are undertaking for a campaign, and trying to understand when the PCs do something you might not understand to figure out what's going on there. And then he speaks about the micro decisions, so like the small things that the PCs do, like equipment or things in combat that seem unconventional and you don't quite get the feel for what they're going for. And then it sums up with that this idea of asking about their intent. It's not a thing that you need to do all the time. It's just a thing that you need to do when you're not sure. Does that sound about right, JT?
Yeah, you nailed it.
All right. So you wrote it, but if you have any other thoughts that you'd like to add on to it, since, you know, a 1,000-word blog post is not necessarily being able to talk about it like this.
Right, exactly. I've been in a few situations where I was pretty sure it was obvious. I knew what the player's intent was. And so I adjudicated the rules a certain way. And then I'd get a look from the player like, hey, man, that's not really what I meant. You know, that was a weird outcome. That's not what I meant to do. Or that's not what I wanted. Even though he had a successful die roll, I gave a narrative based on what I thought he wanted and what the dice said, and combine those two into a narrative. And then the player was like, dude, that's really not what I wanted to happen. And I thought it was very obvious. So at that point, I actually would stop the game and go, okay, what did you intend to happen? He'd let me know. And we'd retcon the last, say, 2 minutes of game time. And I don't retcon a lot. I don't recommend it because it can really throw off the narrative. But if it's a short burst, you know, like say the last 30 seconds to 2 minutes, that's cool. Roll the tape back and record over it and keep going.
Can I ask you a question real quick about that?
Sure.
This idea of people not enjoying the retcon. Like, I've played many, many traditional games at this point, or OSR games, or whatever the gamut of games is, and story games. I've found that editing, I put it in quotes, but like retconning, sure, editing is what I like to call it, is a thing that has become more and more prevalent in games. Like, it's not such a big deal anymore as long as we're all okay with it. And it's an expected thing. But for a long time in the games I used to play, retconning or editing was a very frowned upon thing. Like, you wanted to keep consistent with the story. Do you think that there's a shift in that? Or do you think that that's just kind of the way it still is? Or do you think maybe we should just all accept the fact that we should be able to edit our games?
Well, I definitely think we need to accept that we need to be able to edit our games, either for continuity or agreeing with player intent, in this case, things of that nature. I think a lot of retcon comes out of rules misunderstanding or misinterpretation, where you play with a certain rule for 3 or 4 sessions and then somebody actually reads the rule correctly, or maybe they find some an errata online or whatever, and then they come to the table and say, hey guys, we've been messing this up. And sometimes the instinct is to, well, let's redescribe or rewrite the, you know, let's do the Star Wars re-release thing where we edit what has already been around for 20 years or 30 years. And that's really probably a bad instinct. The way that should be handled is, okay, let's just change how we do it moving forward. And everything that already has happened is, and just leave it at as it is.
I would agree with that. Phil, did you have any thoughts on that little side topic?
Yeah, I mean, I think the challenge that comes up with retconning is that it'll sometimes interrupt the flow. But I also think that in my younger days, I was more concerned about keeping like a constant flow. Like, we're going to keep this game running at a player level and not disrupt it. But as I've kind of gotten either older or influenced by indie games that kind of have that meta level thinking, I'm not as concerned about continuous flow. I've come to realize that you can get flow in these like really good bursts of, you know, a scene, two scenes kind of thing. And the idea of coming out of it to fix something, especially if something's gone wrong and it'll actually work better by doing that edit, I don't really have a problem with it anymore. I'm more accustomed to that punctuated flow thing and less concerned about that continuous flow.
Maybe this will be a topic for a future Gnomecast, but thank you both for indulging my little side tangent there. JT, let's get back to the topic at hand. Player intent, what are some other thoughts you've had about the article since you've written it?
Sure. So if a player says, my character does something, and they describe it in very terse terms, like I kick him, usually there's something more behind those three words than you'll ever get out of those three words. Mm-hmm. So obviously, if they're just in a toe-to-toe slugfest and I swing my sword at him, roll some dice, and off we go. But if there's a environment wrapped around the instance of combat, like in this, the example I'm thinking of, they were on a spiral staircase and they had the high ground over some skeletons. And the player just said, I kicked the lead skeleton. And I pictured like a soccer kick to the head type thing. What he was picturing was more of a push kick to knock the skeleton down the stairs and hopefully take his friends with him. So I said, okay, roll to hit. He hit. And I said, okay, you're not a monk or a martial artist. So roll a d4 and add your strength bonus. And he looked at me weird, but he did the dice anyway. And then I said, okay, well, you do 2 points or 3 points of damage, whatever it was. And he said, well, that's it. I said, yeah, well, you kicked him. You're not effective at kicking. You're more of a sword swinging kind of guy. And he shook his head and said, no, I wanted to kick him down the stairs. And I was like, oh, gotcha. Mm-hmm. Okay. And so that taught me a lesson of if a player gives out just a short description of action, maybe dive into that a little deeper, ask some questions, like I suggested in my article, you know, get to understand what their true intent is behind that very terse statement of I kick him.
Very nice. I agree with you wholeheartedly, actually. Like, sometimes we think we know what's going on, but we really don't know what's going on. Sometimes we're just not sure. And it's always good to ask that question. When something seems out of context or unnormal from what you're used to, would you say that's the right time to ask that question?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And in this case, I even paused and should have asked him questions before we even did any dice roll to touch the dice, because he had a sword in hand and could swing it. There was nothing preventing him from using the sword. So when he said he kicked the skeleton, that's when I was a little confused. So if you find actions that a player is wanting to take seems to be incongruent with what they've done in the past, or what they're capable of, or if they're even taking a suboptimal course of action, maybe that's time to dive into it and figure out what they're truly trying to accomplish.
I very much agree. Phil, what are your thoughts about the idea of player intent?
Yeah, it's funny. I had kind of a range of thoughts about this from my early gaming days up till now. And I remember when there was a time when games had a bit more of an adversarial relationship between players and GMs that, and I say this both being a player at that time and being a GM, that there was this feeling like you didn't want to reveal your intent. You would probe the GM with like certain questions and not reveal your intent because you were afraid in that adversarial thing that like you were setting something up that you wanted to surprise the GM with. And that if you revealed it too early, the GM might just move towards thwarting it. You might be trying like some unorthodox attack and like, you would just throw out a question like, can I throw lantern oil out on the ground kind of thing? And, you know, the GM might be like, yeah, I guess so. You know, why? Oh, no reason. Not yet. You would like keep it to yourself for a long time. Like, I remember playing like that. And I remember like GMing like that. Like, there was very much that kind of like, well, you don't want to give the GM all the info yet because his bad guys could move out of the way or something like that. Or he could use that kind of that intent to turn it around and counter what you were trying to do. And now, like, now I look like at more, I look at more modern games. And I really, when I read this article, it kind of brought me to thinking about Powered by the Apocalypse games a lot, because in Powered by the Apocalypse games, there's really like two things. I mean, there's many things going on in the game, but two things that made me think about this article. And like the first one is that those games remove that adversarial relationship between player and GM. With that principle, be a fan of the characters. So it takes that away and it basically says like, look, the GM is actually a fan of the characters and actually wants the characters to do well. Even if they make it really hard on the characters, which is actually their job, you shouldn't be adversarial. And then the other part that got me thinking about it was that idea of lead with the fiction, where we start by talking about what we're doing and then we look for the move that it triggers. And the real trick here is that often you need to know the intent to get the right move. For instance, there might be like an orc closing in on a party member. And you're like, well, I'm going to run up and, you know, I'm going to run up and attack the orc. Now, in Dungeon World, there's two moves that could possibly be triggered. We could trigger just hack and slash where you run up and hit the orc and attempt to kill it. And there's defend where you're trying to protect the person that the orc was going after. And so knowing intent actually helps figure out which move you're going to trigger. So as a GM, I actually have to ask that question. I have to say like, okay, I get that you're running up to put yourself between the orc and your friend, but are you trying to protect your friend or are you trying to kill the orc? Because what they pick is going to, you know, help me figure out which move I'm going to use. And by being a fan of the characters, we're open for the player to say, no, I totally just want to put my sword right in this, you know, orc's face. Okay, great. And then I know to pick the appropriate move. And so thinking about that, like it works great in Powered by the Apocalypse, but I also thought you can easily abstract that to talk about it in use in any game. And it's really about like one, it's like JT said, understanding intent, especially for those unorthodox things, really helps make the game run smoother because the GM can then actually act appropriately. You need to have that trust, that GM player trust, that what you say as a player and the GM hears that the GM's there to help out and make the story better and not thwart your ideas. And I think maybe in newer games and maybe in newer gamers, that adversarial thing isn't quite as pronounced. But, you know, if you're older, like me, like you might have to ease people out of that mindset. And then using that intent, that's how you kind of figure out how to adjudicate the rules and, you know, how to come up with the right rulings to help, you know, the player do what they're accomplishing. And then finally, if your NPCs, your villains, are going to react to something that a player does, keep it above board and have them make a roll. If somebody's throwing oil all over the ground and you think, well, the orc might know to, like, get the hell out of the way or something, you can just simply say, like, well, I'm going to make a perception check for the orc. The orc's successful, he notices the oil and moves himself around it, and if he doesn't, he's going to attempt to walk through it. Because he's just, you know, he didn't see it on the ground.
And at least he didn't understand what was going on.
Right, or he didn't understand. Exactly. Like, by putting it to a roll, then the player doesn't feel like, oh, well, you totally screwed me on my plan. No, the orc isn't that dumb. Like, he caught on to it. That kind of thing.
I just want to talk about this idea of the adversarial GM for a second.
Sure.
I don't think that the adversarial GM has any place in gaming anymore. Because I think the adversarial GM is a mockery or a perversion of what the idea of the referee should be. Because I don't think there's anything wrong with the idea of the referee in games where the game master is there to adjudicate what the players are doing and then letting the dice decide what happens. Because that is very much an old school play style, right? Like it is you exploring. It is you delving into the dungeon. It is you trying to overcome the things that are in front of you. And it's not the GM's job to kill you. It's the GM's job to present and allow you to do stuff and then make rulings when the rules don't necessarily cover what's going to happen. So I'm pretty pro get rid of the adversarial GM altogether.
I mean, I was pretty pro get rid of the adversarial GM when, like, you know, I was a kid in the 80s. Like I didn't actually enjoy it as a kid. And it's probably the reason why I gravitated later to story-based games and more collaborative games. Like, I didn't actually enjoy that experience. I mean, I had a number of times where the GM that I first learned D&D from, who was very adversarial, killed my characters in ways that were probably kind of arbitrary and didn't feel very good. I didn't really enjoy that he made a ruling and, you know, my character got killed as a result.
JT, what do you think about the idea of the adversarial GM?
I'm kind of glad that it's extinct, or at least near extinct. It's definitely a dinosaur of ages past. In like Phil, I experienced that as well as a kid and through junior high and high school. Kind of where it was a me versus them or a them versus me kind of mindset, because I mean, all of us were fairly new to role playing and we kind of were all new to it together. So we were accustomed to when we sat down to play a game, there was a definite winner, you know, whether it be Monopoly or chess or checkers or you know, name any number of games that existed before role playing really hit. There was a definite winner at the end of the game. And most people, when you sit down to play a game, still have that concept in their head and they don't realize that's not really the point of a role-playing game. And it took a while to understand that and outgrow that. And by a while, I mean a decade or more, at least for me. And I never did enjoy being against my friends when I was game mastering, and I never enjoyed being against the game master. But I didn't know how to fix it. I didn't know. I knew I didn't like it, but I didn't know why. And it just took time and maturity, really, to get past that. And I think now that folks like the three of us are bringing, the next generation into gaming, we're not teaching them the bad habits that we started with and then subsequently broke ourselves of and have moved on from. So I really have high hopes for the future of gaming as far as removing the adversarial GM and doing the more collaborative storytelling and, sitting down just to have fun instead of trying to beat each other up using dice.
I have one last thing to ask, because you said something that's fascinating to me. I know we've kind of bounced around the idea of player intent, which I think player intent is related to a lot of this stuff. Like, if you are an adversarial GM, you are not interested in the player's intent. If you were retconning, it is because you didn't understand intent, things like that. But you said winning is not the purpose of a role-playing game. Now, I know me and Phil on other shows have talked quite a bit about what we think the purpose of a role-playing game is. What do you think the purpose of a role-playing game is?
Oh gosh. Well, number one, have fun, because after all, it is a game.
Mm-hmm.
And a game's intent, back to that word, is to provide fun for those present, those participating. Of course, fun is a very broad term, and you know, how do you go about having that fun? Really, I think it is going to be those highlight moments, those awesome die rolls, because the dice do still, you know, play effect in at least in most games. So it's when, you know, you make that impossible roll and pull off that awesome event against, what appears to be overwhelming odds, whether they are or not. But yeah, just, having those stories to tell later on down the line. I used to be an active member of the Society of Creative Anachronisms. There was a, campfire tradition where you would, pass around a bottle of whatever adult beverage of somebody brought for the night. And tell stories that started with, no crap, there I was.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what role-playing games provide, I think, is those stories. So that not are you only enjoying them in the moment, but you get to enjoy them through relatable stories down the line. Now, of course, I can't go to my grandmother and tell her my role-playing stories because she's not going to get it
because
mm-hmm. she's never role-played before. But when I run into fellow role-players that I've, say, never met or whatever, yeah, I can talk about those adventures and stories. I try to avoid the telling people about my character because that's kind of the trope way to turn somebody off. But if I tell them about the amazing things my character did, there's a bond there.
Yeah, I agree. Phil, do you think you could do it in less than 60 seconds?
Can I do it in less than 60 seconds?
Yeah.
I don't know. Ask me the question again. Let me see if I can do it. Ready?
What is the purpose of a role-playing game?
For me, I also will say it is also to have fun, and then I will say that it is to create a collaborative, shared experience of telling a story together. That is my most concise answer.
And that was in less than 30 seconds. Impressive.
I know, right? I even let you ask me the question again.
Mm-hmm. I'm with Phil, actually. That's why I asked him, because I figured he'd just give my answer, which he did. I thought that, JT, your answer was pretty much right in line with ours, too. So,
yep.
Yeah, I'm with you. Well, that's GnomeCast 11. Thank you both for being here. Before we get out of here, let's do a few Patreon shoutouts. So these are folks who back the Gnome Stew. So thank you very much, Jack Evans, Monty Young, and Steve Farrell. We greatly appreciate your patronage. All right. So this show is funded by the Gnome Stew Patreon, and you can be a Patreon backer by following the Patreon link of the Gnome Stew website to the Gnome Stew Patreon. This ad has been brought to you by Traps by Kobolds. I know you thought I was going to say Patreon. So, JT Evans, where can we find you on the internet?
My one-stop shop is just jtevans.net. And from there, in the upper right corner of every page, or at least pretty much every page, you can find links to all my social media.
Very cool. Very cool. Phil, where can we find you on the internet?
All right. I'm not going to be quite as concise. If you want to follow me on social media, best place to find me is on Twitter at DNAPhil, although you can find me on Facebook and G+ as well. If you want to see what I'm working on, you can go to encodeddesigns.com. And if you want to hear me, you can hear me with Chris on the Misdirected Mark podcast, broadcasting live on Twitch, 8:45 p.m. Eastern on Tuesdays, or wherever else you get your podcasts. And you can also hear me record with my other co-host, Senda, from She's a Super Geek, on Pandas Talking Games, which is also part of the Misdirected Mark network.
And Senda is also a fellow gnome.
Yes.
You can find all of us, because Phil basically hit where I am, at Gnome Stew on Twitter, the Gnome Stew Facebook group, and at GnomeStew.com, where you can hear other great episodes like this one, or read a bunch of lovely articles by the other gnomes. And please, please do so that we don't get thrown into the stew. Well, with that, I will say goodbye and go have a little bit of stew.